Not on the reading list. I don't know why I didn't have it on the reading list for Spirit of Christianity. It is a deconstructed reading by Werner Hammer. Pleroma, reading the Hegel, which reads it completely differently than I do. So if you want the anti-Bernsteinian reading, this is emphatically it. You can criticize my reading point by point, everything I've said before. Werner is also one of the best readers in America, or Germany, wherever he happens to be at the moment. He's here. Is that in my unit now? Yeah. So he's just down the block, and he knows how to read further. Okay, let's begin. At some point, we'll get a class list to pass around, but we don't have one yet. So we'll just do some philosophy. I am assuming that, as you know, on the syllabus, I say topics, not weeks. I'm assuming that it will take me about 2 weeks to get through this text. I can drag it out, but I'll see if I can do it in 2 weeks. I will do it in 2 weeks, but I don't think I can do it in a week. And this is one occasion where if you have no desire to take notes, you can avoid doing so, since the essay by me in your syllabus is, this is an occasion where I've written on this text, and I don't have anything wildly different to say than what I've already written. So you can just relax, listen, enjoy it, and then if you want to read what I have to say, that's fine. So this is just going to be a version of that. Okay, last week, one further thing. First of all, I've been up since 6 this morning working, so I've already put in a 14-hour day, which means I may not be completely cogent. So if you're thinking, wait, that doesn't make any sense, it's probably because it doesn't, in which case, please stop me, please ask questions. That's the right thing to do. And it helps me. It doesn't interrupt my flow. It really helps me see what I'm saying and the like. So please feel free. Last week I offered an epistemological introduction to the phenomenology, suggesting that Hegel's move was from I think to we think, in which the we think was the removal of any externality. Hence the idea of idealism as being infinite. And I tried to say the notion of infinite is not anything beyond the world, it's the critique of Kant, right? It's a critique of Kantian finitude. And I want to repeat that argument this week by offering an ethical introduction to Hegel. And I should say right away that the whole trick of the phenomenology of spirit is to connect these two problematics, the epistemological and the ethical. And the reason I want to go back to this early essay of Hegel's, 1798-99, is first of all, it is the most readable text Hegel ever wrote. Dilthey says Hegel never wrote anything finer, and I agree with that. But I also prefer it over Hegel's Jena writings, the other bit of early or young Hegel, because in those writings, Hegel is already beginning to work out his system. And what I think about this text is it does not represent Hegel's system. I want to be clear, it represents his ethical and philosophical vision. And it represents his vision better than, I think, those other writings. It shows you what he really wanted to say, what he really cared about. Now, what he wanted to say and what he really
cares about is here embedded in, as I'll say more about in one moment, a wholly spurious ontology of light and law. And it's this spurious metaphysics of love and life that he eventually has to get rid of, and I'll explain how he does that in a moment. So, this is, and it's typical Hegel, this is Hegel, all this text, every moment of it, when you read it, is about the critique of Kant. It's about the critique of Kant's moral philosophy. Nothing else is at stake. He's thinking about Kant in every single sentence, and he's thinking about two things. He's thinking about the general structure of Kant's moral philosophy, which I'll describe as him finding intolerable in various ways. And of course, he's also modeling this text, again, in ways I'll elaborate, after Kant's own philosophical reading of Christianity, namely religion within the limits of reason alone. What Hegel wants to do here is replace Kant's morality of universal law with some notion, what I'm going to call ethical living, or some notion of the structural contours of human experience as such. Now, Hegel's idealism is constituted, or so I'm going to argue for the next 27 weeks, by this identification of the normative logic of ethical life, is going to be identified with the structure of experience as such. So the idea is we're going to get a notion of what ethical interaction is, and we're going to use that to model our relationship to the world in general. So this is, if I may steal a phrase from a philosopher I despise, namely, this is ethics as first philosophy. And this is really, as I suggested last week, getting rid of epistemology as first philosophy, that is, the representational idea that we stand in relation to the world by means of representing it, and replacing it by an ethical relationship. At the center of Hegel's ethical vision in this essay is what has come to be known as through Habermas, is the causality of fate. He who actually gave it this title. And the causality of fate is an ethical logic of action and reaction. The thought is, this is just Hegel's thought, if he has a thought, which, by the way, he stole from Fichte, so it's not original. It's something you all should think about. Philosophy is one area where you don't have to be original. Be a good thief. A good thief is the most one can achieve. Hegel was not a good, but a great thief. And he stole this idea from Fichte. The thought is to act against another person, to do what we nowadays call acting immorally or acting wrong, not to break some transcendent law, but to destroy your own life. That when you act wrongly, you call down the avenging fates. And therefore, the thought is you cannot ethically harm another without ethically harming yourself. That all, we might say, wrongful action, let's call it, since I'm going to end this today by talking about the logic of love, let's call it breaking the bonds of love. To break the bonds of love is to destroy the other and yourself simultaneously. In this way, this logic of the causality of fate is right, then the flourishing and foundering of each life is intimately bound up with the flourishing and foundering of everyone's life. As the young Marx said, right? As long as one is unfree, then all are unfree. The question is, how do we make that thought true? It's going to take us 28 weeks to get that thought in place. It's a hard and difficult thought, and I'm not convinced it works, but we're going to try, because if ethicality isn't about this, then it probably isn't about anything worth knowing at all. Well, that's my view. So, social space, as I'm going to think of it, is always constituted ethically, normatively, as a space in which subjects are necessarily formed or deformed, freed or oppressed, through the structures governing their interactions with one another, and with nothing beyond that. Nothing beyond that. So Hegel thinks, and this is his disturbing thought, I guess, is that ethical life matters independently of any particular moral norms, moral principles, moral laws, or moral ends. Ethical life is going to be about the quality of our intersubjective life, not about our relationship to some abstract norms. Now, all this, again, is embedded in an inadequate holistic metaphysics of love and life. By this thought, I mean two things. First, that the metaphysics of this essay is emphatically a metaphysics of life and love. Now, to say that it's a so that life and love are here going to be Hegel's first idea about the invisible or secret bonds connecting us with one another. Now, we're connected by participating in a life together where the notion of life must be read in two ways. That first of all, the notion of life together is the sense of having a life, like get a life. You say get a life, we don't mean you're not alive, we mean get into connection with what you need to get into connection with. In order that, the second thought now, is that this has something to do with vitality and being alive in the biological sense. So that practical life and being alive are going to be thought to be interconnected. Now, there's a great debate about this text. The Great Debate, is it an anti-theological document or a theological document? Well, certainly this much is true. It is anti-theological in the sense that Hegel is going to suggest that all Christian God talk is simply a means for expressing the metaphysics of life and love. So that to talk about God is just another way about talking about ethical life. That's the sense in which it's anti-theological. That is, it gets rid of any notion of a transcending God. That simply is kaput, and it's kaput for Hegel from the get-go. There's never any transcending God in Hegel. So the only question is whether there is an immanent God. And this is the old pantheism problem. Is pantheism a form of theism or a form of atheism? Who knows? I mean, if you know the answer to that question, you should be up here telling us. It's very hard. It's fraught, and it's certainly fraught in this essay, and it remains fraught in Hegel. My thought is that, or my belief about it, is simply that insofar as there is no transcendent God, then there is an inevitable drift within pantheism toward atheism, and that there is nothing to prevent that drift. And I believe that that's Hegel's thought. That is, secularism is the correct fate of religion. Now, in translating Christianity into ethical terms, Hegel is simply following the model of Kant's religion within the limits of reason alone, since that's what Kant did, right? He read the Bible, and he just translated it into Kantian moral philosophy. And indeed, Hegel had already done that in an earlier piece called The Life of Jesus, rewritten the same text. In fact, it is the same text, because at that point, the argument is perfectly Kantian. At a certain moment, sometime in the late 1790s, Hegel realizes that Kant is the problem and not the solution. And this is him working through the thought that Kant is the problem. So the idea is to show that there is a logic of experience implicit in early Christianity. It's simply there. In fact, actually, what Hegel thinks is that, and this can be baffling when you read it, because what Hegel thinks, and this is kind of one of the tricks of the text, is that Jesus is doing practically, namely revealing the ethical content of theological discourse that Hegel is doing theoretically. I.e., Hegel and Jesus are doing the same thing, only, you know, Hegel's doing it a little later and theoretically. But the realization is that that's what Jesus was doing. He is a theological, he's a decoder of theology. He's bringing theology back to life. He's replacing law with love. I mean, that's what he says over and over again. And, you know, the only problem is 2,500 years of Christianity, well, 2,100 years, have completely misunderstood him. have ignored what Jesus was doing, have tried to make him a transcendent thinker rather than an immanent one. So there's a kind of heresy in this book, that is Hegel's identification with Jesus. Still, the model here is much more modest. And the model, again, is Kant's religion book. So we ought to retitle Hegel's essay and call it Religion Within the Limits of Life Alone. That's the project. Religion Within the Limits of Life Alone. And the thought is, when you do the decoding, there is no excess and no remainder. Nothing left for God to be but our relationship to one another. Second, I said that it's inadequate holistic metaphysic of life. To say that it's a metaphysics of life is first of all to say it's a logic of part and whole, which we saw was the discovery of reading the Third Critique, that you could replace relationships of universal to particular with relationships of part and whole. Put that at the top of your page. That movement is all this text rehearses. It sets up the structure of universal in particular. Let's call it Noah, Abraham, the state, positive law, Kant, and replaces it with the logic of part and whole. Call it love, call it Jesus, call it life. Now, why that movement should be revolutionary, that's what we've got to figure out. But that's the structure. So, like everything in philosophy, it's always a matter of boring logic. The exciting stuff always has beneath it a conceptual scaffolding where all the stakes are. All the stakes are always in the logic, never in the fancy rhetoric. That's a Hegelian thought. Hegelian, Hegelism, crazy kind of logician. Well, to say that it's first part and whole, the other thing is to talk about life means that we can begin to talk about a language of living and dying, since things that are alive can also die. Things that are alive can also be injured. They can suffer. They can hurt in various ways. So introducing a language of life is also going to be a way of naturalizing ethical language, or bringing ethical language back to, let's call it, the vicissitudes of the body as the model for the vicissitudes of the spirit. Say that again. Use the vicissitudes of the body, the way it suffers pains and harms and injuries, as a way of mapping and structuring the vicissitudes of spirit. That is, when your lover spurns you, you hurt. When you get called a name by hate speech, it's a form of injury. When you feel yourself spurred or demeaned or humiliated or without stature or standing in the world, you suffer. We have got to find ways of making what sounds at first like a metaphorical transition from body talk into moral talk. We want to find ways of making that as literal as possible, so that we don't need any other talk other than our ordinary talk of injury, wounding, hurt, harm, and suffering, living and dying. We live and die biological death, but we also live and die, as everyone knows, spiritual deaths. Well, there's good reason to use the language of life here. Unfortunately, if you use the language of life, you end up with a kind of garbage pantheism. That's what's wrong with it. So Hegel's going to have to get rid of the notions of love and life as his model and replace it. In place of love, he's going to have the notion of recognition. And in place of life, he's going to have the notion of spirit. That's the translation manual that will get you from this essay to the phenomenology. Okay. That's what we want to work out over the next 3.5 hours. Okay. I'm ready to begin. I don't know what to say to the charge that this is an anti-Semitic text, except to say that I find no evidence anywhere in Hegel that he was an anti-Semite. I think if anything is a problem here, it's that he's simply insensitive to these issues in the extreme. He just doesn't see them. Which is all I have to say about the matter. Okay, let's begin. Although Hegel regards Abraham as the true progenitor of the Jews, it's not unimportant that he begins this story with an account of the flood and of the contrast between Noah and Nimrod on one hand and Deucalion and Pyrrha on the other. So how does this text start? Why does he start with the flood? Well, in a sense, he starts with the flood because the flood is what destroys the state of nature. For the state of nature is that time when man and nature lived in a state of harmony. State of nature here is not Hobbesian state of nature. It's kind of paradisical. It's a good time had by all. And then comes the flood. Hegel says of the flood that it was destructive, invincible, irresistible hostility, and manslaughter. Which reveals what? What does it reveal? What does the flood reveal to us?
Nature doesn't give a damn about us.
Nature doesn't give a damn. It's nature's indifference to the human that is revealed. And that leads to a certain problem. Namely, we've got to cope with nature, which is to say, we have to control and master it. So the point of beginning with Noah is to show that Western rationality is emerging at this very moment. Nothing earlier than Noah. And Western rationality that begins with Noah emerges in response to the need to master threatening nature. This is not Adorno and Horkheimer, this is Hegel. It just so happens Adorno and Horkheimer read Hegel. So, the claim is going to be, first of all, the first thing that this tells us is that this text is a genealogy of moral reason,
that the critique of Kantian morality is different than it's going to be in the phenomenology. We're going to be sick to death of criticizing Kant, but this is going to be a different one. This is going to be a genealogical critique by showing that the fundamental gestures of Kant's philosophy repeats the earliest gestures of the emergence of reason that occurs with the emergence of Judaism. And the emergence of Judaism is all a unraveling of the logic of the response to the flood by Noah and Nimrod. So that Western rationality has as its fundamental contours the idea of the mastery of nature, and that the deep understanding of Judaism, of course, nothing to do with God. God is always a red herring in any argument. You always have to figure out, in any argument, what God means. And the notion of God signifying this or that just simply varies from context to context. But it's never, never about God. It's always about, it has to be about, because there is no God. I mean, that's why. Punchline, there is none. If that's a shock to anyone, I'm really shocked. But there is no God. Ergo, whenever we see the word God, we've got to figure out what it means by figuring out what it implies for our relationships to one another, to the world. That's the only thing that can be at stake. So every concept of God is a concept of a life of a certain kind that is a picture of a certain kind of life. I just take that to be a gimme for grown-ups. I take it we have people who share this great nation of ours who are not grown-ups. Some say even the president. So the thought here is that what is going to be called the deforming and perverse quality of Jewish life, the criticism of Judaism, and hence the deforming and perverse quality of Kantian reason, derives from the fact that it appropriates a form of rationality designed to master hostile nature. That the inner structure of morality, I'm going to argue, is a replication of the rationality for the mastery of nature, and it applies the logic for the mastery of nature onto human relations so that we subject ourselves to the same logic to which we have subjected nature. So it is going to be a story of what we might call instrumental reason all the way down. Now, it should not be surprising to us that the fundamental critique of Kant should be a critique of him as a repetition of instrumental reason, because the fundamental gesture of Kant's philosophy was a critique of instrumental reason. That's what it was all about. When Kant says, I had to limit reason in order to make room for faith, he could have said, I need to limit instrumental reason, that is, the reason of Newtonian scientific reason, the reason of the logic of cause and effect, so the reason that understands the world through scientific rationality. Kant realized, and this is beautifully done in a book by Richard Belkley. What's the name of Belkley's book?
Remember?
Yeah, he follows the Belkley line. Well, they were undergraduate students at Penn State. Anyway, Richard Belkley.
Freedom and the End of Reason.
Thank you. Freedom and the End of Reason. Really wonderful book about understanding Kant is coming out of Rousseau, certainly, right? But the thought is something like this, that Kant realized that if
Newtonian science represented all the notion of rationality and truth in the world, then two things arose. First, the one we all know about. If everything is governed by the laws of cause and effect, then there is no freedom. But secondly, and this is what really did it for Kant, if everything is governed by the laws of cause and effect, then we can't understand science either. Because science is a human product. The notion of truth is a human idea. And Kant realized that in order to preserve the value of truth, right? It was Kant who discovered that truth has a value, right? Not Nietzsche. Then we had to limit science, bring it within a notion of self-determining reason. And furthermore, show that there was a different logic of morality. Okay? So Kant's project was a critique of instrumental reason. That was its purpose. Now, what Hegel's simply going to argue is he didn't succeed because his own idea of moral reason is actually the same as his notion of theoretical reason. That practical reason and theoretical reason are not sufficiently different, and that therefore the same logic that he criticized, he also brought into morality. Okay. Hegel proposes that there are just two fundamental ways in which one can master nature. Either through something real, that is, through some collective practical activity, like building a city or building a tower or building a boat, or if you're the Dutch, building a wall, you got to do something. And that's, you know, no avoiding that. And that's Nimrod's solution. Or through something thought. And this is going to be Noah's solution, which is here presented as the invention of the Jewish God. But it's Noah who invented the Jewish God. And this involves two steps. First, the posing of an ideal, things ought to be different from this, against hostile nature. And then, why not? If you're going to have an ideal, you might as well give it some oomph. So let's say that the second step is giving the ideal reality, being. Well, take an ideal, let's call it the ideal of the good, and give it reality, give it being, and what do you got? You got God. That's how you get God quickly. Now, the thought then is, of course, that God's the master of the world. So God's a kind of transcendental ego. He gives us the contours of the world. And therefore, all the world is essentially a thought reality, because all the world is nothing but an object of God's intellect. Well, this is puzzling, or you should be puzzled, because what you want to ask is, how does thinking about God as the master of nature help me master nature? There's got to be a missing step. Well, of course, again, there is no God. So I'm going to say that the missing step is what I call the theological contract. And the idea of the theological contract is simply this. God promises to restrain the forces of nature on the condition that human beings master their nature. Nature within Namely, we master our murderous, incestuous desiring hearts by obeying fundamental laws of conduct. So the thought is, because God's relationship to nature is actually always mediated by what? By our relation to ourselves, that is, by human obedience, then the ebb and flow of nature in relation to man is only ever a register of human obedience and disobedience. Or what is to say the same thing, nature from this perspective is never anything but a sign of man's relationship to God. Nature is hostile, we've been sinning. If nature is kind, then we've been good. And that's the way it works. Now, since nature is almost always hostile, then we are almost always sinning, and therefore we are a stiff-necked and hard-hearted people, the continuous reiteration of the Old Testament, and we never get it right. Okay, now, therefore, the fundamental stakes about relationship to God is our relationship to ourselves. Therefore, page 187, it was through God alone that Abraham came into a mediate relation with the world, the only kind of link with the world possible for him. Now, this is where, so what we're going to imagine is that in the first instance, Abraham has a direct relationship to the world, and then via this story, the relationship is going to go via God so that Abraham is never in direct relationship to the world. Let's cash that out and see what it means. Noah and Nimrod represent, of course, the two faces of Kant's critical project. Nimrod is a code for the Kantian understanding. Verstand. Noah is a code for reason, or Vernunft. That is, they represent the understanding and reason, respectively. Those are the only two possible relationships to the world imagined by instrumental rationality. They represent two sides of an self-defeating strategy. Hegel says, and this is his thesis, both made a peace of necessity with the foe and thus perpetuated the hostility. Page 184, both made a peace of necessity. By necessity, they made peace with their enemy, and that's good, except it's also bad, because they thus perpetuated the hostility. This is the brief version, in miniature, of Hegel's intuition here. And the thought is this, that the logic of causal manipulation, and self-subjection to external authority, both these ways of operating, both subjecting nature to law, mastering nature, and subjecting yourself to law, obeying the categorical imperative, right? Those are both versions of the same. And what they do is internalize the conception of the other, nature without and nature within, as antagonists. That is, both ways of relating to the object assume that the only possible relationship of it is it's an antagonist, and therefore you must master it and control it and dominate it. So the only possible relationship to the other is one of domination and control, and no other relationship is possible. Well, this depends upon thinking of, let's call this relationship, the direct one, a horizontal ethical geometry, and we'll call this one a vertical ethical geometry. And the reason why, of course, Hegel is going to argue that every vertical ethical geometry is deforming is because this thing, whether it's the moral law or the idea of the good, or God, doesn't exist. Always a problem. So the problem is we're going to project outside of life an idea and subject ourselves to it and therefore deform these internal horizontal relationships, relationships of, again, love and life. So, how does this begin? It begins with Abraham wanting to be autonomous. He wants to be, Hegel says, an independent man, overlord to himself. So for Hegel, Abraham's action of tearing himself free of his family, which for all the world looks like, except he's too old for this, what every adolescent does when it eventually leaves home, that is the normal mechanism for becoming autonomous, is done, and this will be the criticism, with intolerable coldness. And is the coldness and indifference in the action that qualifies its violence. Abraham tore himself free, I'm quoting now, page 185, and this should be puzzling to you. He tore himself free without having been injured or disowned, without grief, which after a wrong or an outrage signifies love's enduring need, when love, injured indeed but not lost, goes in quest of a new fatherland in order to flourish and enjoy itself there. What is that sentence about? Obviously important. Well, one thing it assumes is this, that there are good grounds for rebelling. There are good grounds for going to seek to found a new state. But this, by the way, I'll say more about it in a second, but this is telling you the same story that we get in Greek tragedy. He understands this as the moment of moving from a family, familial social structure to a political social structure. So this is the beginning of Western sociology. And that's clearly what the Judaic story is fundamentally about. It's about the end of family tribal relations and the beginning of political or civil relations between human beings. That is, replacing love by law. This is the inevitable step here. What Hegel finds troubling here is why Abraham does this. He doesn't do it because his relations with his others has gone wrong. He doesn't do it because he's been stirred, he's been spurned, or because things have fallen apart, or people can't get on with one another. He does it. Why does he do it? Because we know why he does it, because God called him. That's what's scary. It's scary because, and I want to be clear, for Hegel, it's scary because there's no human reason why he leaves and breaks up the family. On the contrary, there's something horribly inhuman about Abraham's act. And Abraham, by the way, in this story, is a monster. This is why it's a scary story. So the thought is Abraham wasn't injured. He suffered no wrong. So that Hegel is, of course, suggesting, of course, if things go wrong, then you want to try to do something else. You know, your love fails, you get a divorce, you go looking for, you know, it happens. Right? But that's not this story. Right? There's no injury. Indeed, he says, and I can't think of anything harsher Hegel could say, Abraham wanted not to love, wanted to be free by not loving. What kind of being is that? Well, it's going to be the being who invents Western rationality. That's the kind of being. But we ought to be clear that Western rationality has built into it this refusal of love as the fundamental ground for our relationships with one another. So the fulfillment of the Noah strategy requires the self-subjection to an ideal, to external and authoritative norms of conduct. To found a nation on this basis is to replace the internal norms of communal sentiment with moral norms, with laws. Hence the thought that this is a repetition of the story of Greek tragedy, that Abraham here, just to anticipate, is going to be very similar to Hegel's Creon, and that Isaac is going to be very similar to, but not as wonderful as, Hegel's Antigone. But the story here is of a similar structure. So we have to understand in the case that Hegel's reading, it is the radical discontinuity between these two forms of social organization, the family and the state, love and law, that is the source of the problem, their discontinuity. Abraham seeks to found a new nation at the behest of a purely abstract or ideal norm, where it is promised and presumed that what this means is the rejection of, the utter rejection of all previous, let's call them sentimental forms of human bonding. So this is the replacement of sentiment by concept. So the first act, again I'm quoting, you know, sometimes people think I make these stories up about these texts. So I just want to indicate that I am trying to read it. The first act which made Abraham the progenitor of a nation is the disseverance which snaps the bonds of communal life and love. So Abraham's nation-founding act is a wholesale displacement of sentiment by law. And in doing this, he has to do this by separating himself from nature completely. We call this separation from nature completely monotheism, the creation of an invisible, untouchable, unseeable, unthinkable, unknowable God. Page 2045. I'm going to do this quote and then we'll have a break since I'm sweating like a pig here. This is, of course, the passage that a lot of people find unacceptable. It represents the Jewish people as abjects. And I want to suggest it represents them as abjects in pretty much Kristeva's terms. He says that the great tragedy of the Jewish people is no Greek tragedy. It can rouse neither terror nor pity. For both these arise only out of the fate which follows from the inevitable slip of a beautiful character. It can arouse horror alone. That's the anti-Semitism, right? Horror alone. The fate of the Jewish people is the fate of Macbeth. No Greek tragedy that. Who stepped out of nature itself, clung to alien beings, and so in their service had to trample and slay everything holy in human nature, had at last to be forsaken by his gods, since these were objects and he their slave, and be dashed to pieces on his faith itself. I'm not going to try to do the reading of Macbeth here, although that would be interesting. The thought here is, why is horror the only response? It's a response because what appears here is an abject, and the human becomes abject when it steps out of nature itself, when it's expelled from nature. In so doing, it sheds its human shape and human appearance. Now, the reason why this can arouse us to neither terror nor pity is because it's not quite an intelligible human fate. That is, it's not a fate with which we can, in principle, identify. So in Hegel says of Abraham, page 186, that he became a stranger on earth, a stranger to the soil and to men alike. We should read this notion of being a stranger in ontological terms. That he is ontologically a stranger because he has shed his likeness to nature. That is, there's no affinity between him and nature. And hence, he has lost the physiognomy of the human. Now, of course, repudiation of the human is the most human thing we can do. We do it all the time. But it's not tragic, in Hegel's sense, by which he means there's something about this structure that is not further transformable. Once you step out of nature, there's no further step. There's no way we can reclaim you. There's no way we can turn this into, you know, make lemonade. You can't make lemonade out of Abraham. There's nothing good here. This is the epitome of, and here I mean this to sound exactly like Nietzsche, that the fundamental structure here is the human repudiation of the human. We call that morality. Let's have a break and then I'll try to prove that. Yeah, a good break, 15 minutes, because it's really hot.